I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Our guest this hour, the reporter Cy Hirsch, broke news stories that changed the way we see our republic and ourselves. The composite of his innumerable scoops over 50 years is a picture of a secret security state that was carelessly, ruinously out of control before we'd ever heard of Donald Trump. Hirsch pictures himself as the survivor of a golden age of competitive, critical, serious, popular journalism that's dying fast, he says. And who's to bet that the man is wrong? The man who told us about My Lai and Abu Ghraib and the CIA wiretapping on us. At 81, Cy Hirsch is full of his cheerful, hustling self in his memoir titled Reporter, I, Cy, in the Times headline over a flattering review. And he's equally energetic in our conversation this week.
There was a fat sergeant there. He said, stay here a second, please. I said, why? He said, I'm supposed to call the colonel. And I beat it out of there, and he started following me. It was a scene out of a bad Mel Brooks movie. You know, just running down the street. I could outrun a fat sergeant any day. And I did.
Listen to Cy Hirsch talking, and you can see him chasing a story. I had watched him do it all when we were colleagues in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times in the 1970s. He's ever on the move, leaning into the wind, gossiping, bluffing, wheedling his way through the bazaar of information, dropping names, grabbing documents and phone numbers. At the end of the day, he has spun a few clues and suspicions into a big ball of notes and leads. This is how he broke his first awful shocker, the killing spree of young American soldiers in the village of My Lai in Vietnam back in 1968.
What it was I got a tip. I had covered the Pentagon for the Associated Press for a couple of years, and I went off. I worked for Gene McCarthy in that campaign. I wrote speeches and was his press guy and stuff like that. Got very disillusioned with politics eventually and went back to being a reporter. I wrote a book about chemical and biological warfare, et cetera, right. Et cetera. Did a lot of writing. And Bobby gets killed and stuff goes on. Anyway, but in 69, in late 69, I was doing a second book about the Pentagon, and I get a tip, just one of those
crazy things.
Well, it's more than that, just that. Like you, I'm sure, I was a reader. I read about the war. I fell in love with the drama. I wanted to be a correspondent. Mm. I used to pick up the Times every day and read about Neil Sheehan and Malcolm Brown and David Halberstam, of course.
Homer Bigart, yeah.
Homer Bigart, Maury Safer of CBS. And I did read long sections about the war in Vietnam that were devastating. And I knew from covering the Pentagon that often things got out of control, that murder was not uncommon. So I got a phone call from Jeff Cowan, whose father had run CBS a decade earlier that I didn't know at the time. And he was a lawyer new to town, and somebody had called him and given him a tip about a terrible crime that was being prosecuted in secret by the Pentagon. And what the suggestion I got, or the inference I made, was that the Army was busy trying to convince the main perpetrator to plead guilty and get it all just resolved as they could. Plead out, take 6 months somewhere in some jail, and that's it. And so he tipped off Cowan, who figured I might be somebody who would look at it. And I just somehow thought, I'll give it a shot. So I went around asking questions. And you know how it works in the Pentagon.
Maybe never covered the Pentagon.
Well, when you cover the Pentagon, you learn to judge officers by their personal integrity. There are officers who give you cant when you see them. There are some officers who will say, well, here's what's going on. Look, kid, you want to know the whole story? If you protect me, let's take a walk. And there are a couple of guys like that. So I knew a couple of guys. I'd been in the Army. I know the Army keeps record. If there was some murder somewhere, it'd be reported. So I went to the legal office and began looking through archives and found nothing. I began going through press releases and found nothing. I found nothing to indicate that there was anything untoward that happened in Vietnam beyond the usual. What I'd been told, it was 75 people, and I'd been told it was an enlisted man. And all those things I was told initially were wrong. It was an officer, and it was a lot more than 75, like 550, something like that. Anyway, I run into a colonel I knew back 2 years earlier, but he's limping, and he's also now a general. And so I saw him, and I said, oh, my God, you're a general. And I said, oh, you took a bullet just to make general, huh? And he's laughing, and we're walking. He's limping along. And he said, it's all right. He said, no more combat. And I said, so what's your job now? He said, I work for the chief of staff, General Westmoreland. And I said, so what's this about some guy shooting up a bunch of people in Vietnam? And he stops, And he says, oh, Sai, he said, you don't want to do that. That guy, Kelly. And he reached down. It's one of those magic moments. He reached down and he began to hammer the side of his hand against his bad knee. He said he didn't shoot anybody higher than that. He's just a coward and he deserves the rot. And he said, it's not worth your time. I finally got a bite.
A name.
A name. I said, so I hear you. So from there, I found a Kelly that had been 2 months or 3 months earlier. The government had put out a three-paragraph press release from Fort Benning, Georgia, saying a first lieutenant named William Kelly Jr. was being held in connection with the murder of an unspecified number of civilians. That's what they said. And so I remember calling up when I saw that, Fort Benning, the press office. I said, what's this about Kelly? And the colonel who ran the press office took the call, perfectly nice, and he wasn't lying. He was told what he was told to say. Oh, he said he shot up a gin mill. You know, got mad and Saigon gin mill with a prostitute or something and shot up a bunch of people. He said, that's the only guidance I have for you on that. Nothing to it. And so that didn't make sense to me. And I knew the colonel who told me that wasn't lying. I knew he'd been told. So I knew it went high. And so I actually had to go back to Jeff Cowan. From Jeff, I got the name of a lawyer named Latimer.
I was just going to mention that guy. I mean, there's so many lessons here, Sai, in the way a shoe leather reporter works. When you got to the lawyer, you said, I hear he killed 150 people. And the guy said, no, it was only 79 or something like that.
I doubled the number that I had been told by Jeff Cowan. He said 75. I said, I hear he killed 150. And then the lawyer then went to a file, pulled out a piece of paper, and let me see it. It was the charge sheet. The first sentence said was accused of killing the unwarranted or whatever it is, premeditated murder of 111, get this, Oriental human beings. And then he took it back. And what I did is I spent 20 minutes pretending to talk to him while copying it word for word upside down, the first couple of paragraphs. And he told me the story. I was just a firefight. And then he put away the paper. And I said, I'm going to Fort Benning because I think Kelly's there. And he didn't say anything. I said, just want you to know. So within a day or a few days, I went to Fort Benning getting there. I remember I took a 5 o'clock flight, 6:30 in the morning. And I spent all day looking for him. I thought, the Army being the Army, he's going to be registered somewhere. He'd come back the previous summer, late summer, he said, August. And so what happened is I went to every club. The golf club, the swimming club, the motorcycle club, the hunting club. I went to looking for Kelly. He wasn't listed anywhere in the barracks. He wasn't listed anywhere in the phone book and et cetera. He was obviously coming back for an investigation. He was obviously had been accused. So I started looking. I was going to go to prisons. It turned out Fort Benning is monstrous. It's as big as all of New York. All five boroughs aren't as big.
Wow.
So I started driving. There were five different bases there. And I started driving to the jails, to the lockups. And I went to two or three and I would park in front, pull up my tie and my brown gray suit and walked in and asked the sergeant, get Kelly out here right away and stuff like that. And it was no Kelly. And so hours went by of looking, just driving. I went back and I knew he was there because I went to the JAG office, the office of the judge advocate. They would be prosecuting him. And I remembered from my days in the Pentagon, the military was always very very precise about phone books. They changed them every 3 or 4 months.
Right.
So I called information, and I asked for the chief operator, and I said, would you please go to the previous book, which was June, I was right, the June book, and look for new listings. If you remember in the old days when we had phone books, if you got to New York after the phone book was out, you always had could call up information for new listings and find it. And she found it. He was in an engineer battalion, of all places. So I went there. It's a big barracks, just full of beds. And so I went to the side of one of them and went looking for Kelly. Thought he's going to be here somewhere. That's where he's listed. I thought by midday, he's obviously not an engineer. He's just hiding here. And I went through one side and all the bunks were made beautifully. In my day, you drop a quarter and a head of bounce. All the bunks are made perfectly, row after row. To get to the other side, I had to crawl under the there was an upper and lower door. The lower door was closed to the office, and I crawled like I was in Vietnam or something under to the other side. And sure enough, on the second floor, there was a kid in a bunk. I was very aggressive. He was sleeping. And I go and I kick the bunk hard. I said, wake up, Kelly. And this kid, blonde kid, about 19 or 20, a farming kid from Ottumwa, Washington, Iowa. And I said, excuse me, son. I said, I was looking for somebody else. Will you explain, what are you doing sleeping here at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 3? And then I said, so what do you do all day? He said, well, the only thing I do is sort the mail. And I said, "You ever hear of somebody named Kelly?" He said, "You mean that kid who shot up and killed everybody?" I said, "Yes, not going Eureka." He said, "This is where he lives, but he's never been here." I said, "Well, what do you do with the mail?" "Well, I wait a week and I send it down to Smitty at battalion headquarters." I said, "Where's Smitty?" He said, "Well, he's just probably working." I said, "Let's go." He said, "Oh, no, Smitty. Well, Smitty just got his stripes taken away. He was drunk or something. He's too mad." So I said, "What time you got?" He said, "It's 3 o'clock." I said, "All right, in 8 minutes, I'm going to be at the back door. I've got a red Ford I rented, whatever the color was. 8 minutes sharp. Check it now. Starting now. Take me about 8 minutes to get there." And I ran out, and sure enough, there he was, the only action in town. And I drove him to where Smitty was. There's this big, fat sergeant picking his teeth with a gold toothpick, literally. I say, "Sergeant, get Smitty out here right away," figuring Smitty just had his stripes taken. The sergeant started laughing. "I'll get him out here." He thought he was in more trouble. Everybody, you know, thought I was somebody serious. So Smitty crawls into the car and he's nervous. And I said, "Don't worry, kid, I'm looking for Callie." And he said, I don't know where he is. I know that he's living with some guys off base and they come and get his mail." And I said, "Well, what do you have?" He said, "Well, I might have his 201 files."
Right.
201 is the files. Everybody in the Army, even officers, it's a personnel file. I said, "Is Callie's 201 file is in your office?" He said, "Yeah, I think it has to be, yeah." I said, "So?" He said, "You want me to get it?" I said, "Why not?" 3 days after losing his stripes, right? And he said, "Okay." You know, screw the Army. He goes in, doesn't say anything to the sergeant. The sergeant's just laughing. He comes out, and he gets back in the car, and in his shirt, he unbuttons it, and there's the file. And the first page is the same page I'd seen a couple of days earlier in the lawyer's office.
Right.
And there's an address where he lives.
There are a million lessons in this saga, Cy, about reporting, about persistence, about luck, about military phone books, about bluffing, about trading of information.
But eventually I found him there. Somebody led me to Kelly, and I met him. And Kelly's first words to me when I found him, he'd been motorboating. I hadn't called that club. And the first thing he said to me is, "Oh, my lawyer told me you'd find me." As if it was that easy. Anyway, we talked. He gave me a story. I wrote it up. Nobody cared.
Wow.
And so there I was.
Coming up, getting the My Lai story was one thing. Getting it into print was another. This is Open Source. The scoop artist, Cy Hirsch, is our guest, reliving his first big breakthrough, getting Rusty Calley's version of the U.S. Army massacre at My Lai 50 years ago, and then finding that American magazines and newspapers didn't want to publish it.
It eventually got out, but I had to publish it myself through an anti-war news service.
I was just going to say, Cy, I mean, if there's genius in this book in your career, and surely there is, it's in knowing that you had to own the story yourself. You had to be your own editor, your own salesman, and it continued. From the Times to the New Yorker to the New Yorker
Review of
Books.
It's more than that, Chris. I had to own the copyright. The
exactly.
Newspapers were buying a story from me. My law firm said it's legal. The copyright was mine. They were just buying a story from the New York Times or the smallest newspaper. We charged $100 each. It made 35 newspapers. But, you know, I was actually frightened. I was frightened that nobody wanted the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even from our days together at the New York Times, the Times eventually got into the Watergate story, but hated it at first. There was always a sense in the New York Times that certain stories would just soon be second at. I think it's changed now.
This is an important piece of the whole book, Cy. Bill Kovich's observation struck home to me that on the Watergate thing, the New York Times profoundly in its most inner being didn't want to be in a confrontation with the President of the United States. That's not what they do. But it also underlined for me another fundamental point about journalism most people don't understand, I think. It's one thing to sniff out the story and write it, but you're nowhere until you find somebody who will publish it.
Well, you know, once it got out, what happened was Louis Heron of the London Times took a liking to my work, and the London Times had been running some of my freelance stories, and they bought the My Lai story. The second story that I did, I quoted one of the guys who actually was there saying it was a Nazi-type thing, putting people in ditches. And the London Times was then the eminent paper in London.
Right.
They splashed it all over the page one. It led to a debate in Parliament. And that debate was covered. And then the New York Times got happy. They covered the debate. And then they sent Henry Kam, a good reporter, to that area. And then they got a sense of how true the story was. And then I found this guy who actually fired into a ditch, killing hundreds of people, clip after clip. Mm. I found him somewhere in rural Indiana. I was just never home, on the road. I went to rural Indiana. I found him. And then he agreed. We couldn't pay him. My little news service was selling these stories now all over the world. The editors were calling after the first story saying, what do you got for us next? The same phenomenon. Let me do the story. This is 1969. By the second or third story, I always knew, you know what? I could have the major media. If I had the right story, I could have them.
Right.
I mean, the same thing I thought in Alba Grabe. And so what happened eventually, I had a terrible time with Abe Rosenthal then. But 2 years later, when I was hired by The New Yorker in 1970, and Abe called up. And Abe was a great editor, although we fought.
Right. Yep.
He was always worried about my politics. You know, by the way, I don't know how you feel about it, Chris. Ours is a profession. When I go to my dentist, I had root canal. And I didn't ask the guy whether he was pro-Trump or anti-Trump. I just knew he was a good dentist. And I think a newspaper reporter, it doesn't matter what we think. It's how we write and how objective we are and how sensible we are. It's not our politics. We're entitled to have politics. Now, Abe had different politics than me, but he hired me to do Vietnam, I'll tell you, from Washington. Shake it up, because he knew the coverage was lousy. He used to come into the newsroom and give me a Bill Murray rub, the noogie, they called it. He'd do a noogie on me, and he'd come up behind me in the bureau in Washington, and he'd say, how's my little commie today? And then he'd say, what do you have for me?
Cy Hirsch's long account of My Lai became a special issue of Harper's Magazine and then a book. A chilling spoken version survives in conversation with the Chicago radio legend Studs Terkel. Cy Hirsch, with the man who'd been his idol growing up.
And My Lai 4 was one of many hundreds of little hamlets in this particular region in the northern part of South Vietnam. Nothing special about it. We like to think... Of course, there is now, but before they destroyed it and murdered everybody in it, it was just another hamlet that everybody assumed that most of the people there liked the Viet Cong. It harbored Viet Cong.
There's so little we know. I mean, generally speaking, about phrases that are used, and even now, it's going to lead up to My Lai. You spoke of the body count and the number of people. It doesn't matter. It's abstract. Enemy
sure.
killed. It became a free fire zone.
Free fire zone is another wonderful word. That means that since it is a hostile area per se, the Viet Cong are known to operate there. We designate, this is something done unilaterally by the United States. There's no precedent for the international law, what you will. We simply designated great areas of South Vietnam as free fire zones from which we can order strikes by helicopters and by bombers and by artillery and by men without any clearance from anybody. We just would go in without any warning to the population. The basic point is that anybody who was in the area is a VC supporter. Often when officers would have not much to do, they'd get in the helicopter and they'd go hunting people with pistols.
And then you go into the more
day.
The day itself. Medina, in the meantime, you know, shot a girl, and they'll take a break for a smoke, and nothing happens.
That's the most interesting thing, is that around 9:15, after they perhaps had killed 200 people, they sort of all took off their helmets and their flak jackets, you know, dumped their packs and lie down and took a smoke. Then they got up and started shooting again.
It's so as though they had done calisthenics and take a 5-minute break.
Sure.
And that's it.
What happened is very simply. They were told the night before the VC would be there. They landed in a landing zone, which normally in a combat operation, when you land, the helicopters are very vulnerable. That's why we lose so many helicopters. They jumped off, no fire. They walked into the village. Women are cooking rice. Right? They're all having breakfast. The men and the women, there's not very many men, the kids. So the first thing they do is they start collecting everybody in the groups, about 100 people. And then, on orders from one of the officers, they turn their rifles on the automatic and they start killing them. And in the other half of the village, that's on the one side. On the other side, the guys are running through, going up to houses, or hooches as they call them, ordering people out and picking them off one by one as they come off. This is all going on in the first hour. About 100 or so people were taken to a big ditch in the back, shoved into the ditch, and then a group of men got around and shot them. And then they were done. They all threw hand grenades in there.
Callie shoots a 2-year-old kid. One
gotta
of the guys.
Read that.
Yeah.
I hate to do it, but I think everybody ought to know what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I'm just sharing the misery. Okay. There's about 80 or 100 people in a ditch, right? And they shoot them. You know, one of the kids told the army, he said, the people were firing. This is a kid who didn't shoot. So the people firing into the ditch kept reloading magazines into their rifles and kept firing into that ditch, and then killed or at least shot everyone in the ditch. A guy named William Lloyd of Tampa, Florida, said that some grenades were also thrown into the ditch. Another kid remembered that a lot of women had thrown themselves on top of their children to protect them, and the children were alive at first. Then the children who were old enough to walk got up, and Callie began to shoot the children. One further incident stood out in many GIs' minds. Seconds after the shooting stopped, a bloody but unhurt 2-year-old boy miraculously crawled out of the ditch crying. He began running towards the hamlet. Someone hollered, "There's a kid." There was a long pause. Then Callie ran back, grabbed the child, threw him back in the ditch, and shot him. I guess he was a VC, you know?
I want you to tell the Abu Ghraib version of chasing it and then getting it into the New Yorker. That's an important one.
It's the same thing. It's all about reading. I read Amnesty International, and I read other groups that were human rights groups. John Sifton, I remember in particular, were doing wonderful reports on torture in American prisons in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Hmm. And everybody should remember John Walker Lynn, the first Taliban who was brutally tortured in front of everybody in late 2001, and everybody applauded. So I knew there was something there. After the war, we were grabbing members of the Iraqi intelligence service and putting them to work as assassins for us. And I'll tell you, it's an awful story. And we were also gathering all the generals we could and putting some of them to work for us too, as against the Al-Qaeda, et cetera, up to a point. And one of them we missed was a 2-star who had worked with the UN. He and I began to exchange information. He was in signals intelligence for the Iraqi military, and we'd missed him. He was reduced to selling fruit from his backyard and a little stand to make a living. And he couldn't get out. He had a daughter in medical school there in Baghdad, and she didn't know English to go someplace else. Anyway, I got to him and convinced him, paid $700 of New Yorker money for him to take a cab to Damascus. Mm-hmm. He holed up in a hotel with me over Christmas for 4 days, and we did a lot of serious reporting about a lot of really bad stuff inside that we were doing, theft, et cetera. He knew a lot. And about the third or fourth day, he mentioned Abu Ghraib. And I said, "Oh, yeah, what about it?" He said, "That's a big prison." He said, "Oh, my God, what's going on there?" He said, "I have many friends whose sons and daughters and wives have been arrested." And I said, "Yes." He said, "They're all writing home to their fathers saying, please come and kill me." They were saying, "Come kill me because I've been defiled." So I knew something was going on. So I went back to the human rights stuff. You know, you couldn't write it without evidence. America wouldn't accept it. Just as they wouldn't accept the My Lai story. I'm sorry, it's just true. The press then wouldn't accept that we would do such terrible things in a jail. What happened was CBS 60 Minutes had found some photographs and they weren't publishing them. And I began to talk to the people they were talking to. And I eventually got not only the photographs, but also the internal report that a wonderful general named Antonio Taguba had done.
Yes.
And the brilliant report. I knew that everybody involved in 60 Minutes wanted to publish it, but the leadership was afraid. They were being told by the White House, by George Bush and Cheney, don't you dare publish these pictures. You'll kill American troops. So they were frightened and held the story for a few weeks. And finally, I told them if they didn't run the story in the next week, I was going to run my story in the New Yorker. And I had more pictures than they did. And also, I would say in the third graph, they weren't running it. So they ran it that Thursday.
This is a picture of an Iraqi prisoner of war, and according to the U.S. Army, Americans did this to him. The Army confiscated some 60 pictures of Iraqi prisoners being mistreated, and in many of the pictures, Americans, both men and women, are laughing, posing, pointing, or giving a thumbs up.
They began the show, by the way. I'll never forget this. Dan Rather, who of course wanted to publish it, he began it by saying, I just want to say before we tell you this horrible story that the only reason we're doing it is we know another publication is prepared to publish this information very soon.
A postscript. 2 weeks ago, we received an appeal from the Defense Department and eventually from the chairman of the Military Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, to delay this broadcast, given the danger and tension on the ground in Iraq. We decided to honor that request while pressing for the Defense Department to add its perspective to the incidents at Abu Ghraib prison. This week, with the photos beginning to circulate elsewhere and with other journalists about to publish their versions of the story, the Defense Department agreed to cooperate in our report.
I actually wanted the photos out. And by the way, to Dave Remnick's credit, every editor's instinct for a scoop, but he understood that if we had a report that was brilliant, that came out after the photograph that had been seen by the 18 or 20 million people, it would have much more impact. And Remnick, even though he and I had some a lot of disagreements, it was a brilliant editor, and he said, okay. We could have scooped CBS, but we let them do their job. And then we came out 3 or 4 days later with this wonderful story that even the New York Times had to lead the paper with. You know, nobody in the New York Times likes to read somebody else's other story, a New Yorker magazine story. But, you know, they were very good. All the press was.
Cy Hirsch, stand back a moment. I mean, we're talking about heroic journalism.
No.
Seriously, don't
heroic,
blush.
Heroic, come on.
We're talking about continuous.
Just journalism. Journalism 100. That's what I think.
Okay, but there's an irony, if not real tragedy, in both of these sagas. The My Lai massacre story became part of our language, and Richard Nixon was reelected
yes.
In 1972. Abu Ghraib similarly became part of our vocabulary, and George W. Bush was reelected in 2004. It makes you wonder, what is wrong, not with that old journalism, but with us?
You know, it's very funny because in the summer of 2004, I knew John Kerry when he threw medals, as you remember, 1971. John Kerry is a very decent guy.
Yeah.
He was running for president. Everybody thought he had a good shot. And I had my wife and I went to a dinner party with some people very, very prominent in his campaign. And the issue became, why aren't you going after him on Abu Ghraib? Why aren't you attacking him for this horrible, horrible thing that's how we've been reduced to? Mm. And they decided, they thought they could win the election by taking the high road, talking about his patriotism and his medals. Mm. I keep on seeing one of my friends and said, how did that turn out, your decision not to go after him viscerally, George Bush and Cheney? They didn't do it. You know, we now have Trump. And so you have to say to yourself, okay, anti-Trump stories. My own instinct, I don't have anything more than that, is Trump is much more media savvy than we know.
Right.
He's gone up 7-8 points in the last 4 or 5 months, Mueller or no Mueller. The farther away we get from an indictment, you know, and we are pretty far away from it at this point, the more nervous I get about it, and the more I think he's going to be reelected, unless something dramatic happens. I don't know. I'm just saying. But the point is, Trump is catnip now in terms of internet traffic, ratings, particularly on the East Coast for people that hate him. So for the New York Times, which is going up exponentially in the number of people are subscribing it to and online,
right.
Every 3 months they report another 200,000 people. Not necessarily getting the paper, but getting it online. That's money anyway. The Washington Post is doing the same thing. If you'd like Trump, why you pay no attention to us? You just go to Fox News or the papers that represent that point of view. And so the notion of the great newspapers of our time as a reasonable barometer of accuracy and independence, like my dentist, gone. Because
right.
They're so anti the Trump bias against them. And I can give you chapter and verse of people they've gone up and down. That wonderful lawyer from Russia that allegedly was at a meeting. I can't pronounce her name. It's the famous meeting when the Russians were going to give some dirt. I happen to know a lot about that meeting. It was about the adoption policy of Russia. Adoptions in Russia will take 6-8 months. And Putin canceled it in rage over something known as the Magnitsky Act. And I just happen to know the history. And she was a lawyer representing some of the people who lost their children in adoption. And she was reviled in stories for going to this meeting. I'm just telling you, literally, one particular example. She had ties to Russia, ties to that. It was all about there was going to be dirt delivered on Hillary. By the way, who needed more dirt on Hillary? She was what she was. She wasn't likable. I'm sorry. 2 weeks ago, the Senate released all of the testimony that they had about that meeting. And the trouble with the lawyer was she didn't want to talk about anything but about adoptions. And as the Washington Post reported, in this, there were 3,500 words or 35,000 words. They said she droned on and on about the adoption policy. Did they correct the record? No. Did the New York Times correct the record? No. They had maligned her in 20 different stories linking her. It's always this business of linking that gets me so nervous.
Hmm.
And, you know, anytime the government says we have high confidence that the Russians did something, I remember the high confidence about WMD. So the high confidence that Russian did the hacking, why don't you tell me they did? Then you know it. But they don't say that. Why wouldn't they say that if they did know? That's the way I look at it. But that's not perverse. It's just good journalism. I don't think it's being practiced that much right now.
Hmm.
You know, let me just say, I think Trump's playing us all. Here's the thing about a guy like that. He beat 17 or 16 to 17 Republicans. It's so easy to underestimate him. Yes, he's a big mouth, and yes, he doesn't read. But he's also a circuit breaker in a funny way. I thought, you know, he just might look at wars economically. And he might say, 28,000 troops in South Korea? Boy, I'd like to get rid of those. I'd sure like to start a public works program with $5 billion that I have in the budget, put, you know, 4 or 5 million people back to work and win the election in 2020 while the Democrats are still running around calling me nasty names. And so far, I see nothing that makes me think he's not going to do something dramatic with public works, with money he's going to save, because he's not expanded the wars all over. He talks about it, but he doesn't. We're getting out of Syria. I'll tell you that right now. He wants to get out of Afghanistan. He's going to do it, I think. He may just cut back troops. He may cut a deal with the North Koreans. There's been 3 or 4 peace conferences between North and South in the last 2 decades. And in no case was the South as yielding as they are now with the new president. And so for the first time, there's a basis for something going on that Trump doesn't have much to do with. And the Chinese, I mean, the Chinese must be exhausted. You know, they have so many troops guarding the Yalu River, keeping anti-regime North Koreans from fleeing across. There's a tremendous problem the Chinese have with Koreans sneaking into China across the border, just like we allegedly have going on with Mexico. The Democrats better start talking policy and stop talking about how bad Trump is. I have this visceral instinct that he may surprise everybody just as he surprised the Republican parties.
Coming up, a panoramic frame around a 50-year career. This is Open Source. Looking ahead with Cy Hirsch, I asked him, is there a better way for institutional media to cover President Trump?
Yeah, sure. Cover the agencies. Beat the hell out of the agencies. The New York Times does a very good job, and Washington Post on Pruitt. The woman who runs education, she makes it easy. But there's a lot of other agencies that aren't getting another. Interior's a disaster. There's a lot of very bad stuff going on. And yes, his personnel policies are awful. And yes, he doesn't promote anybody that doesn't adore him and publicly praise him. And yes, he probably got rid of Tillerson because he wouldn't deny he called him an idiot. And yes, the great hope we have is Mattis, who is a very tough warrior, but seems to be the one guy who has to, you know, poor Mattis, he has to say a lot of things. When Trump does something, he has to stay loyal to Trump. You can't be disloyal. You know, but let me just say this about Trump. It's awful. Yes, we're in a real bind, but America is not going to fail. We're not going to go down. We will survive Trump. There's only so much he can do. But focusing every day, you know, he dominates the news, and he does it deliberately. He's got us in the East Coast. We're in a complete tither about him. It's catnip, as I said. We want to read more bad stuff. The Washington Post will say 19 interviews with people who told how crazy he is on the inside. You don't need a lot of reporters telling you how crazy he is. He tells us right to himself. He is what he is.
It's water off a duck's back. What if we just stop talking about him? I've almost stopped reading about him.
Well, I've stopped reading about him, too. You know, Giuliani says he can indict himself or he can indict impeachment, all that stuff. I just can't read anymore because who cares, A, what Giuliani says, and B, it's just fodder for the nightly news. Where do you get the news?
Where do you get yours? I get mine more and more from the FT in London.
I have to acknowledge I have a son that works for the nightly news broadcast on HBO by Vice News, which is, I can tell you, so far superior to what passes for news these days and network news. It's very superior. People actually talk for 3 or 4 minutes in sentences.
For me, the real beauty and power of this memoir, Cy, is that it's a history of you and me and our generation since we got out of college, basically. And it starts in Vietnam. It ends after Iraq, Afghanistan with Trump. And it's a very, very disheartening half a century. 50 years at a glance, the problem that you've been confronting all your professional life is the security state, the CIA. And today the CIA runs secret missions everywhere in the world, including drones, including Syria. We don't talk about it. There's almost no news story that can puncture the power of that institution, which JFK, after the Bay of Pigs, wanted to dismember, cut into 1,000 pieces. Where are we going?
Let me just add to what you just said. The other unit you're not mentioning is the Joint Special Operations Command, There was a study recently done by the Watson Institute at Brown University. We're in 76 wars, roughly 80, 90% of them Joint Special Operation Command operations, many in Africa. We have no idea of the corruption of the system right now, of what's going on. We have no idea. And nobody wants to tell us, and we're not asking the right questions. We're too busy listening to Giuliani talk about what Trump says.
Well, we remember Ben Franken saying, we've given you a republic if you can keep it. I mean, what is left of a democratic republic, open, moderately good-tempered? We talked to Studs on the 150th anniversary of the publication of Whitman's Leaves of Grass, and he said, we become the scariest, most dangerous nation in the world.
We are the most feared nation in the world. Whitman saw us the most beloved nation in the world.
It was Cy Hirsch's old friend Studs Terkel, who in his very old age, on Open Source, compared 21st century America to Walt Whitman's country in the 19th century.
Those others are us, is Whitman is saying. He's saying it's grand. The life, the grandness of everyday life, breathing, of living, of doing, the grandness of the ordinary things.
I'm one of those rare people when I was a kid reporter in Chicago that used to drink martinis with him. It was a newspaper town, Chicago, downtown, and there was a bar, I can't remember the name of it, where Suds would hold out, and the guy could drink about 10 martinis a night. And the last time I went drinking with him, I was done after one and a half. I said, I can't do more.
I want a big picture reflection on the 50-year span of your career and of this country. I have a hard time explaining it to my kids, that Trump has been a long time coming and that we're losing control, the people.
I don't think there's any question that many people in the world, and I hate to say it, I think more correct than not, view us as the most dangerous country right now because we're so widespread in military activities. It's very troublesome. I think one thing about the newspapers in general, we're also America-centric. You know, it's also as if somehow if Iran sends troops to help in Syria, that becomes a major, major danger point. What kind of people are they? And we raise all these questions. And meanwhile, we've been in Syria for a long time,
right,
covertly even supporting ISIS with Hillary and Petraeus way back 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, it's just so crazy-making. We seem to be unable to see how the rest of the world sees us. And Trump being uniquely sort of irrational, going to go to a treaty, not going to go to a treaty, going to make a deal with the Chinese, just adds to the sense that we're sort of a colossus out of control. And yet, I can still tell you, I travel a lot, I'm always overseas. There's still something about Americans that's
absolutely
so appealing to people.
You know, I'll tell you the classic story.
Well, I'll tell you a classic story. 4 or 5 years ago, I'm in Pakistan, and I'm doing something about the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the ISI, which is really most scary services of all the ones I know. It's control a lot
the
of
original
bombs,
deep
a lot of
state. Right.
I'm at a lunch at a club in downtown Islamabad, I think it's called the Islamabad Club, with a 3-star. And it's an off-the-record thing. 3-star ISI general. It's 110 degrees out. It's a lunch. I go to lunch with him, just the two of us. And you only can drink juice, no booze. And he's just ranting and raving about the double-cross the Americans are doing. And it had to do with how far into Afghanistan his troops could go. We put a limit on it, but the Americans never respect the same limit on his side. We're always crossing the border deep and doing a kill raid here and a kill raid there, 30 miles in the country. And he was bitching about it. And to the point, I was really, you know, enough of this, you know. I'm an American reporter, so, you know, we're off the record, we're just chatting. Enough is contempt for America. So after about an hour and a half, we're done with lunch. And he wants to give me a ride home. I said, no, I was going to walk in 110 degrees. And then he said, before you go, my daughter wants to go to Northwestern. She's graduating from high school now. And I know you spoke to her. I'm sure you know somebody in the admissions boards. Can you help get her? So I thought to myself, it's the perfect story. You know, here's a guy so mad at us, and yet he wants to send his daughter to us. So we have that going yet.
What should we do?
Chris, you're trying to make something rational that isn't.
No, we're violent.
We're violent. Period. The point I'm making is that there's an element of out of control that we're not looking at about us, and we don't look at it that way. And the New York Times will complain bitterly about Iranian troops being such and such, but Iranian has a long tie with Syria. They don't like each other particularly, but they'll go to support a Bashar any day in the week rather than have a Shia nation, rather than have a bunch of extremely radical Sharia law Sunnis run the country. Are you kidding? I mean, it's not illogical for them to do it. And we have no trouble rationalizing what we do, but we can't rationalize other people's actions.
Out of your books, Cy, the secret villain in your whole professional saga is the secrecy of the national security state, to wit, the CIA, doing secret lethal operations all over the world, all the time, more powerful now than ever, I suspect. But also the story that nobody's told, and I think ails the inner soul of this country, is we still don't know who killed JFK. And the New York Times, even Cy Hirsch, hasn't really wanted to address it. You have a wonderful anecdote, a footnote in your book about how you, Woodard and Bernstein, and Jan Wenner of Rolling Stone conspired, you probably had a few, in the wee hours of a night, said, that's what we should do. We'll finance it ourselves. We'll sell stock in the project, and we will track that story down so that people can believe it. Why not? I think that's the big project awaiting Cy Hirsch in his 80s.
Not a chance. Not a chance.
And
why
anyway,
not? That night was at the height of Watergate, 73, 74, and it involved a lot more than a few drinks. It involved a lot of toking, and, you know, when you're yawning, my God. So I woke up the next morning. We thought we'd sell shares, public shares, for $25 for a public investigation headed by Woodward and Bernstein and Hirsch, right? We were all at the top of the game then. And it was the first time I actually met Bob and Carl, I think, maybe the second time. And I woke up in the morning and I said, no, well, because it's just, you know, it's the trail's dead. Come on. Do you really want me to give up doing what I'm doing now, right now? I'm going to be doing a book.
Another book on Cheney or Saul?
No, I'm going to do a book
about
the
mystery.
Legacy of the secrecy that came out of Cheney that hasn't stopped. I'm sorry. I can't get my head around. I can't get my head around what we seem to know. And if there was something that was more to Oswald, I know people that have duplicated those shots. You know, it was a one in a million shot or whatever it is. Anyway, I'm not going
to
do it.
I'm going to have to ask Oliver Stone for a sequel then. It's, to me, the great unfinished dark
Who's alive?
Hamlet story of our lives.
Let me just leave you with this thought. The premise that in September of 2001, the way to combat the idea of terrorism was to go to war against it. That's quite a thought.
Right.
I'm talking about an idea, and you're going to go to war against terror? Excuse me. It's an idea. Mm. And we failed miserably, and we still haven't come to terms yet with that. And there's still the people who were responsible. The same mindset is still too much in our military, which is to go out and whack and not be thoughtful.
No sooner had we said farewell than I wanted more from Cy Hirsch. I was thinking Studs Terkel, model interviewer, would have asked Cy how it felt to be Cy Hirsch all these years and what remained of his story going forward. I'm coming back for a last word. I want to ask about the feeling in the heart of Cy Hirsch at 4 o'clock in the morning. You are the great bullfighter in the ring all these years, Cy, with our own security state and its dirty secrets.
Well,
what's the score at this point? And how does it feel to be Cy Hirsch?
Look, the government can keep secrets. That's the score.
Hmm.
The government in a pinch can always count on calling in the major newspapers and having the head of the CIA or the National Security Advisor or the president or one of the senior people in the White House and give a briefing and get the story they want on page one next day all over and all the networks. They still have that power. It's the power of the bully pulpit, and they can keep secrets, and they do keep secrets, and there's a lot of stuff going on right now that we don't know anything about.
Mm.
This is not a period of rejoicing at the First Amendment.
The stories and then this policy. You were the guy all those years of the Bush administration who blocked Dick Cheney from realizing his wildest dream, a war with Iran. Who's to block it? That dream that still seems to be alive in our government.
He did want to go, and there were people inside. It wasn't just the fact that
Right.
There were people inside who really fought with him about this. And he did, you know, up to a point he did listen, although that was his dream always. The hostility towards Iran is completely illogical. You know what the basic problem is, in a funny way?
Please.
Is the core issue is that the most of the American, the good American newspapers are homies, you know, in the terms of a sports writer writing about the team. They're America first. And as long as you're America first, you're not going to see things as clearly as you need to see. For example, we're in Syria. Who invited us in Syria? What are we doing there? We're there because we want to be. Sometimes we're supporting the Kurds. Sometimes we even, with Hillary and Petraeus, when he ran the CIA and Hillary was Secretary of State, we were actually actively, covertly, secretly, but actively supporting ISIS or the extremist groups, the al-Nusra and other fanatical Sunni groups. Religious nuts. We supported them too, and against Bashar. But we're not invited into Syria. We're there. But if Syria wants to invite Iran there to help them fight against fundamentalism, and the Iranians, a Shia country, really interested in not having a Sunni ISIS or some Sunni group taking over Syria, if Iran wants to go and support that. We don't differentiate. We see that as a terrible mistake and a terrible crime, a crime against humanity. Iran going to help an ally, but we don't see what we do in that same perception. We can do what we want. It's okay for us to go there. Why? You know, the presumption is we have a rational purpose. And so if we're all over Africa in undisclosed locations doing undisclosed things, why? It's the presumption is we're there for a good purpose. And I'm not sure that's right. I'm not sure we should have that assumption. I'm not sure that's the job of a major newspaper to be that way, but, you know, that's me. I don't think that if the president calls you in and puts you on, you know, makes a demand, I don't think you have an obligation. You certainly have an obligation to listen, but you don't have an obligation. I don't know who defines the national good. I think sometimes the media should define the national good more than some of the people in the White House.
Should it comfort us, Cy, that those newspapers, some of them easily manipulated, are on their last legs, that we have a up from the bottom digital media now that could be entirely different in telling the story of the world?
There is no question that it's all changed and changing rapidly. There's no standard bearer. When I worked at the New York Times, I thought it was, when you worked there, it was a
true
standard bearer.
We
thought the truth was important.
Right.
You could go turn on CNN or MSNBC and the panels. And, you know, not always. There's very bright people on them. But nonetheless, they're asked questions about which the only way they can begin to answer a question about what's going on in the White House is to use these famous two words, I think. I think such and such. You know, I think such and such. One of these days, one of these panelists is going to get one of these questions. What do you think Trump's going to do now about Giuliani? And the answer is going to be, how in the hell do I know? But I don't hear that answer yet. And so there you are. It's amazing.
Let me just say, the story isn't over, Cy, and I'm glad you're still in the fight. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good talking to you, my old friend. Bye-bye.
And still, we hadn't talked about Cy Hirsch's hyper-adrenal tennis game, as aggressive as David Halberstam's, or about his endless war with Henry Kissinger, or about his long and penetrating interest in the CIA's family jewels, meaning the record of assassinating foreign leaders on the unspoken and deniable authority of U.S. presidents since Eisenhower. Nor did we get to his regrettable book on JFK and the dark side of Camelot. There is still more to be said about Cy Hirsch's late work in the London Review of Books, casting doubt on the official consensus that, of course, it was the Assad government in Syria that was guilty of the notorious sarin gas attacks on civilians. Hirsch writes that the evidence is ambiguous. There could have been a false flag operation to provoke the U.S. and Europe against Assad. You have to assume that Hirsch pieces in the LRB are Hirsch pieces that the New Yorker has rejected. History will judge who had more courage or better judgment in all this. Meantime, Hirsch's memoir makes a great case for The Reporter. Visit our website, Radio Open Source, for more Cy Hirsch from the archives and a treasure trove of Studs Terkel. Sign up for our newsletter.
Subscribe to the podcast, leave a review on iTunes, and think of leaving a donation for the hardest working team in radio. Our show this week was produced by the intrepid team of Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi-Done, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.